looking for an interesting podcast? Well, stand by as I talk with the top cop, Gary Raymond.
This is Vince Wall and welcome to Copcast. Today I'm speaking with retired Chief Inspector of Police, Gary Raymond. In the New South Wales Police Force, Gary was involved with investigating some of Sydney's major crimes. One of the worst crimes Gary investigated was the murder of a Sydney nursing sister, Anita Cobby, in February of 1986. 26-year-old Anita had finished her shift as a nurse at Sydney Hospital on Macquarie Street in the city. Anita then had some dinner with friends before catching the 9:12 p.m. train to Blacktown, an outer western suburb of Sydney. Anita Cobby arrived at Blacktown Station just before 10 p.m. and went to a public phone to call her dad to pick her up, but the phone had been vandalised. So Anita began the walk home. As Anita was walking home, a Holden Kingswood came alongside her with five male occupants. Two of the occupants grabbed Anita and dragged her into the car. 2 days later, her body was discovered in a cow paddock at Prospect, which is not far from Blacktown. In just under 3 weeks, Anita's killers were tracked down and all five men were charged with murder. Gary, when did you first hear of Anita's tragic death?
I got called in from home and they said they'd found the body of a young lady, and we got a task force together. And obviously, from what they found at the scene, with her sadly and regrettably having her throat cut and she had multiple injuries, it was obviously a homicide. And we started to piece together. We had a witness who saw her grabbed and thrown in the back of the car. The two individuals grabbed her. And there was, of course, five in the car altogether. Travis was aged 18. Michael Murphy was 33, Gary Murphy, I think, 28 from memory, and Les, 23, and Michael Murdoch was 18. They'd stolen this particular Holden and were out looking for somebody to rob, and also they were looking for a young lady to sexually assault. The witness mentioned that this lady had been snatched, and immediate search was taking place by the General Duties Police and the detectives working at that time. And nothing was found. But then on the 4th of February, that's in 1986, Mr. Reen, who owned a dairy farm, and he had a road near his farm called Reen Road, of course, he saw his cows gathering down in the lower paddock, and he thought that was unusual. And so he went back home. He had to go to a sale. And he came back from the sale, and his dairy cows were still huddled in a circle down at the lower paddock. They called it boiler paddock on his property. And he thought, that's funny. So he went down and went through the circle of the cows, and there was the naked body of Anita Cobby. Of course, he immediately got a huge shock and went to his home and rang the police, and the police attended the paddock. I was called in, and my main tasking at that stage, I was one of the detective sergeants at Blacktown Police Station in our CIB there, our Criminal Investigation Branch, was to find out. We had the evidence of this young lady being snatched into this stolen car, and so I got a couple of detectives and we hit the streets, and our task was, by our supervising sergeant, find out what you can from the streets, particularly from known car thieves, as to if any knowledge about this stolen car. So we went to hotels, we went to the streets, we talked to known drug dealers, we talked to known, you know, brothels and prostitutes, and we went to snooker parlours around the Blacktown and wider area. And it was just, I suppose you could say, turning the place upside down to see if we can get any clues. And given the horrific things that we didn't know at this stage how many offenders it was, but we figured it'd be more than one because of her injuries and the transportation of a body over a barbed wire fence into the paddock would not have been easy for a single offender. And, of course, given the evidence that the five men were seen, well, two seen snatching, but five in the car. So as we worked our way through the streets and through these places, we're getting snippets of information and names. And eventually someone said to us, well, you know, Travers and the Murphys and Murdoch, that mob, they always like knocking Holden's off. And so given the description of the two men that grabbed Anita, we put that together and we sort of started to look at the Murphy brothers in particular as suspects. We continued my team, our intelligence gathering, and trying to put it all together. In the meantime, the autopsy results came back with horrific injuries. We got a bit of information too that at Travers Place, John Travers Place, the Murphy boys and Murdoch, the five of them were seen having a drink and laughing around an incinerator, burning some things. And one of the neighbours rang and said, look, this is funny, it's the early hours of the morning and these five blokes are burning something in the incinerator. So they weren't actually sort of enjoying a fire, if you like. It's February, it's in the middle of summer. And so that put us on to a bit of another path of investigating Travers. Well, finally, we were able to arrest John Travers and Michael Murdoch with the theft of the car. So that's all we had at that stage. And we had Travers in custody for other things, and we had to bail Murdoch out because the stolen car was the allegation. So Travers is in confined, and he's down bail refused in the cells. And one of his relatives came to visit him, and she was a loose relative, if you like, if I can put it that way, not a blood relative, but a sort of a an acquaintance relative he called Auntie. And he revealed to her, quietly and secretly, that he had actually murdered Anita Cobby, because at this stage it was all over the newspapers. The community was up in arms. They were arming themselves. One fellow came up to me and he said, I don't care what you say. He said, I went to my brother's place at Mudgee and got his 22, and he said, I've got that at home, and if these mongrels come near me, look out. And so people were picking up their girlfriends and wives and daughters from the station rather than letting them walk home or catch a bus or even a taxi. And they were arming themselves with baseball bats, and they were being very hypervigilant, because the whole community, after they found out what happened to Anita Cobby, were in terror, really, and just such a fear right through the place. The streets were getting empty because people weren't going to be out. And it was just a whole atmosphere. I remember ringing my wife, Michelle, and saying, make sure you stay indoors, keep the lights out, doors and windows locked, and even if you hear the slightest noise, don't put the lights on, hide, and ring 000. So even that was one of the biggest challenges I had, Vince, was that I was investigating and trying to locate these blokes when my own wife was at home alone. And all of the detectives on the case had the same story and the same fear. So his auntie came out from the cells and she was distraught. And after talking to her, we realised that what Travers had done was confessed to her. So we asked her if she would put on a secret tape. So we applied to the Supreme Court of New South Wales. We got a warrant under the Listening Devices Act. And the next day we sent her in to give him cigarettes, that is John Travers, and to have a conversation with him at the cell door. He spoke again, laughing, and admitted that he killed Anita Cobby by cutting her throat. His auntie stayed pretty stoic and didn't let on any emotion. And all of his confession, and he said that the others had agreed to allow him to murder Anita because they were all scared that she might identify them. And so she then got this full confession from him on tape that we could use in evidence, and then started the hunt. We got Michael Murdoch back in, and then the Murphy boys were on the run, and we found Les Murphy at Travis Place, and then the others were gradually hunted down as people dobbed them in from different places. It took us about 19 days altogether from the time that we found Anita's body to get them all in, and then we got some other evidence, like forensic evidence, together, and the stolen car had been burnt out, but we actually found that, and they couldn't offer us much evidence at all. So we had them in custody, and the next thing was that, of course, I wasn't there, but earlier in the piece, Gary Lynch, who's Anita Cobby's dad, had to go down to the city morgue to identify her body. And her face was in such a terrible state from being bashed, he could only really identify from some other features. And she had a wedding ring, which was sort of like a Russian design. And he identified the ring as being certainly, Anita's. So after they were interviewed and went to court, they were bailed in custody. Of course, bail refused. And I'll never forget this. I was upstairs in the detective's office, and an announcement came over the PA system. All police officers required out the front of the police station urgently with your appointments. Now, appointments meaning gun, handcuffs, and so on. So I quickly put my shoulder holster on, my coat on, and we ran downstairs. Out the front of the police station was a crowd of some estimate 300 or more waiting for the vehicles to come out containing these murderers. And it was quite a shock, because we thought, some had placards and some were yelling, and we thought, oh, well, they'll give them a mouthful as they come out in the vehicles on the way to jail. But as they came up the driveway, the crowd went hysterical and surged forward to get at the vehicles. And they're yelling out, hang the mongrels. And they were yelling out all of these, swearing and cursing and, hang them. And I looked up, and over the wall of the car park of the West Point Shopping Centre opposite the police station was hanging a noose, and in a noose, not a fairly thick bit of rope. And they were saying, grab them, hang them, grab them, hang them. And we actually had to then physically push aside the crowd to let the vehicles through. And I mean, it was vigorous wrestling with them, pushing them aside. They were surging, they were screaming, they were so enraged at what they'd done, these offenders. Well, we got the cars through and off they went to jail. I'll never forget the rage in that crowd. That was a modern-day lynch mob, and you could just see the fear and rage at the same time in their face and eyes, and it was just quite disturbing. We went back into the station and, of course, had a very strong cup of coffee each and described what nearly happened. Every murder is horrific. Every time someone gets murdered, it's violent, it's unnecessary, and it's really challenging for the community and for the family and the police and the ambulance and everybody. But there were some elements in this one which really got to the community's psyche, I suppose you could say. One was, she was a nursing sister, so she helped people and saved their lives on a daily basis. Secondly, she was a beauty queen in Blacktown. She'd won several beauty contests for charity, like raising money for charity, not just her beauty. Mm. She was an absolutely beautiful lady. And, of course, her hands were brutally injured, either with lacerations from the knife or other injuries from these individuals. And so these lovely hands that nurtured people so well in their sickness or injury were now brutalised. And we saw the injuries to her body, the multiple fractures, multiple bruising. And so that enraged, when that got out through the media, that enraged the community. And everybody had a daughter, Anita's age, not everybody, but most, or a sister or a cousin or somebody, a workmate. Mm. And so they sort of almost, I guess you could say, saw their own daughter or female companion, whoever, being murdered like that. They also, you know, stole money from her. When they first abducted her, they put her on the back floor of the car. And now they went, pulled into a Prospect service station on the Great Western Highway, pinched her money out of her purse, and then filled the stolen car up with petrol and paid for it out of her money. So little details like that. And what enraged people too was when Anita got off the train, she normally would go to a public phone, ring her dad, and he'd pick her up. The phones were busted. The two of them, I believe, were smashed to bits and not working. Someone had tried to get them open for the money. And there was no taxis at the taxi rank at that time, so Anita decided to walk. Some of the aggravating factors too, being, you know, walking on a street and a nice summer's night, and then you're snatched, you know, within seconds. You're walking on, the next minute you're in the back of the car with these individuals. That was what enraged the community as well, was putting themselves in Anita's place, and the horror and the terror that she must have felt. The other thing too was at trial, they were sniggering and laughing. I mean, there's a whole number of court appearances. There's the coroner's court, there's the lower court, of course, remand. There's the coroner's court, the lower court, and then trial. And they were just joking amongst each other during this time. And that too, people were in disbelief that they would do that. And the night they abducted Anita, they'd been drinking alcohol and smoking cannabis as well. They met together, they came across each other in a pub at Doonside, and then hatched this plan to do what they did. And I remember too, Alan Saunders QC, at the trial, he was the Crown prosecutor. And he said something like, Anita Cobby suffered a couple of hours of sustained degradation, brutality, he told the Supreme Court. And also to the judge at the time, who was Justice Alan Maxwell. The trial was on, I think it was around June 10, 1987, up at Darlinghurst Supreme Court. And the jury, of course, found them all guilty of sexual assault and murder, and they were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But the judge said something like, he said, I think it was a calculated killing done in cold blood. And he said that the executive, you know, should grant the same degree of mercy they bestowed on their victim, that is the court.
Mm.
And so he said that there was no mercy on these individuals. And yeah, but and what came out of this, Vince, was an amazing thing. I went to visit Gary Lynch and Peg Lynch, who are Anita's parents, quite often. And I just, you know, sit with them and have a cup of tea and just listen to them talk about Anita and talk about how they were feeling and some of the things going through their mind. And I was there one day. They lived in Sutherland Street at Blacktown. And I used to always make a joke with them because they always reckon that I turned up when there was scones, jam and cream on.
Right.
And Grace said, I reckon he's waiting down the road and he smells the scones coming out of the oven, you know, baking, and accidentally knocks on the door and says, oh, how you going? Would you like a scone, Gary? No, I'm right, thanks. Oh, well, they just come out of the oven. And say, oh, all right. Always accused me of waiting down the road. So I was there one day in the lounge room and Gary, Anita's dad, was just staring at me, Vince, just with these sort of glazed eyes, and some tears started flowing out of his eyes down his cheeks. And he grabbed my hand, and then he grabbed my other hand, so he's got hold of both of my hands, and he said, and he's shaking my hands vigorously, he said, Gary, and I said, yes, Gaz, and he said, something good has to come out of something so bad. Mm. And I said, it will, Gary. It will, for sure. With that, those words echoed in my mind even to this day. An amazing thing happened. In the year 1993, Grace and Gary Lynch, Anita's parents, and Christine and Peter Simpson, who was Ebony Simpson's mum and dad. Ebony Simpson was murdered in a shocking way in 1992 in August, I think it was. She was about nine. Peter Simpson, Christine Simpson and the Lynches got together and they formed the Homicide Victim Support Group. That's in 1993. And they got onto an amazing lady called Martha Jable, who came alongside them, and they really got this going. And it's still going today. And I believe that they've assisted after it's the Homicide Victim Support Group specialises in helping people after homicide. And I think they've had 4,000 people being assisted through the group. Well, a couple of years ago, we were having a discussion, and Martha was having a discussion with the Homicide Victim Support Group. And one of the issues that I had as a detective was that if we went to a homicide, and most of them were involved in domestic violence homicides, whereas usually the male, but it could be the female, of course, either way, but one of the parents would kill the other parent and then either suicide, take their own life, or get away and we later arrested them and put them into custody. And the children were left behind. And I remember doing one particular death and a little girl was sitting in the gutter. And I said to someone, "Who's that?" And they said, "Oh, that's the daughter." And I said, "Well, put her in a police car and sit with her with somebody, please." But it touched my heart. And then Martha started to describe their idea of starting a residential refuge for children and young adults, of course, left behind after homicide. And the program and the idea developed, and we approached Blacktown City Council and the mayor at the time, who's now the state member there, Steve Barley, an amazing man. And when he got the concept, we told him about it. He then said, "I'll give you some land for nothing, absolutely for nothing, to build this refuge." And by the way, people need to know, it's a world first. The residential refuge for children left after homicide is a world first. Well, the state government put in a large amount of money, the federal government did, local council has supported us, the workers' club, the Rotary, the retired and former police association, and a whole range of people. We had several variety nights, I suppose you could call them, at Blacktown Workers' Club, raising money for Grace's Place. Well, guess what? As we speak right now, it's of course in April 2020. Had to think there, because being locked down your house, you lose track of time, don't you?
You do.
And so we actually started building Grace's Place now. Grace, of course, was an Anita Kovish mum.
Right.
And we call it Grace's Place because she was a nurse herself, but she had a real love for children left behind after a homicide, or any children for that matter. And so we're well on the way to building it. It'll be manned by volunteers, doctors, nurses, social workers, and other volunteers to look after these children. And so, Gary Lynch, yes, something good is coming out of something so bad. And you know, Vince, it reminds me, as a Christian cop, Romans 8:28. And it's a fairly familiar one to Christians, and it says, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose." Now, that's interesting. It doesn't say that all things are good. And as police officers, and well, everybody knows from looking at the news, and, you know, not everything's good. But God says in his word that all things work together for good. It's like a set of scales. You know, you've got good and bad, and often the bad outweighs the good at first. But as things develop, the scales tilt towards the good, together for good.
Yeah.
And so we need to love God, because when we're called according to his purpose, then he'll show us that things work together for good. And so this is going to be a great thing to happen for the world and for New South Wales. And it was just amazing what we've gotten out of something really, really bad, it's weighing towards the good.
That's wonderful. How do you cope as a Christian detective in such horrific circumstances, going through the investigation and the details are revealed to you, etc.? How did you cope?
Yeah, look, firstly, Vince, you develop some fear because it makes you afraid that people could do this to other people, injure and assault in such a horrific manner. So it makes you afraid of what humans, what people are actually capable of. Secondly, you're afraid for your own family, your own friends, and you get this, I guess apprehension might be the word, of, I hope it doesn't happen to us. And thirdly, it's very hard for non-Christians to understand what's happened in the world as far as, you know, police often say to me, as chaplain to the police post-trauma support group, where was God when this thing happened? Where was God when that thing happened? Why did God let this happen? And they've never read the book of Genesis, Vince, where we read of the fall, where things were perfect. And matter of fact, not good, but says, but very good in the Garden of Eden between mankind and God. Perfect, absolutely, you know, going to be eternal and no suffering, no death, no nothing. And then what happens? Adam and Eve purposely disobey God. And from that time on, it's what the Bible calls, or we call as Christians, the fall. Everything crashed. Sin entered the world, death entered the world, degradation entered the world. And the other thing we read too is that God's given us a conscience. And the Bible talks about where God speaks through our conscience. And he says that his laws for life are written on our hearts. So we're actually walking around knowing what's right and wrong. And because of that conscience, every person that does something wrong or commits a crime, we know that God, the Holy Spirit, that is God himself, would have said to them via their conscience, do not do this.
Mm.
Now, when they disobey God, Vince, and go ahead and do it, God gets the blame every time.
Mm.
And, you know, if people want God to take over and treat them like robots without a free will and take their conscience away from them, but which he won't, that's what came to me as a Christian. I was very sad also, very sad that someone would do that, brutalise such a, anyone really, any murder's brutalisation, and take someone's life. When, the, you know, Anita Cobby, as a nurse, had potential, and if she'd have carried on with her career, I'm sure she would have got to senior level in nursing. She was clever. She had lots of admirers in the way she dealt, you know, did her medicine, nursing medicine. It's a waste. And, you know, that grief and waste we share with the family too. You know, to sit in the lounge room and watch them cry, to see the blank look on their face. As a Christian, I'm saying, Lord, why did those individuals disobey you and abduct and brutalise this young lady? If they'd have just obeyed you, this would not have happened. But that's what happens. God gets, as I said a moment ago, Vince, everyone blames God when really it's our fault. He's shown us in his Bible the way to live. He's shown us in his Bible that Jesus is available to be received for the forgiveness of our sin, which he paid that penalty on the cross and took the God's, you know, anger and wrath on himself. And he rose from the dead to prove that he was, in fact, God, the Son. Yet, no, we want to go ahead and disobey our conscience and do things like, you know, lie or steal something or, you know, commit adultery, whatever those things are, and there's a consequence. So as a Christian cop, I was able to pray with Anita's dad, mum and dad. I was able to pray for others. And now, I'm now a member of the Homicide Victim Support Group. I have been for a long time. And I'm an ambassador for Grace's Place. So I go around telling people the marvellous work that we're going to do and to try and rescue children and young people after homicide and bring them back into some sort of enormous care and concern.
How long can they stay at Grace's Place for?
Yeah, it's $10 million worth of facility, so we've got a lot of rooms there for therapy and accommodation, and they can stay there for as long as needed. What happens is sometimes the place where the murder is becomes a crime scene, and our forensic services and coroner and others are there for a long period of time, so children can't go back there because it's a crime scene being examined. Secondly, children don't want to go back there because most of them have witnessed horrific murder.
Mm.
And it's not only domestic murders, it's any murder where there's children left behind. And whether the children are at the scene, where we've had several others, other murders with kids at the scene, witnessing this horrendous act, and others who weren't there but hear that their mum or their dad or both have been murdered. And so often too, Vince, families left behind are quite dysfunctional at first because they're in grief, they're in horror, they're in disbelief and denial and maybe angry. And so we'll look after the children until such time as they're able to either go to them or, you know, trustworthy relatives or even friends to be looked after. And so we'll also have the ability to train people as well in how to support those left after a homicide. And so it'll be a place of learning, a place of research, and to sort of try and even prevent homicides would be the ultimate game, wouldn't it?
It would. Have you started building it yet?
Yep, we've started building it. We've got the land that we're clearing, and the major sewage and water pipes are going in as we speak right now. And so we should be finished, if we think, towards, depending on Corona now, but we're hoping that we'll officially open it. It might be finished before this, but the official opening will be in June or July on Anita Cobby's mother's birthday, Grace's birthday date. So it's going to be, as I mentioned a few times, a world first. And we've already had inquiries from other countries who have seen our website and our Facebook on, we love this concept, we need this in our country or our county. Or so it's going to spread worldwide, we believe, the concept of looking after kids after homicide.
You mentioned that Blacktown Council have given you some land. So is Grace's Place in Blacktown?
Yeah, it's down at Doonside, which is a suburb down in Doonside Road at Doonside.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not far from the railway station at Doonside. And so, you know, transport's good. And we're going to have, of course, parking there. And we're going to have therapy rooms too, like places, a library for kids to read. And we can read stories to them. The research shows that with children grieving, you try, if you can, to get them into some sort of normal routine and similar to what they did prior to the murder. Also going to have sand pits where they can build things, and Lego, all of those things, particularly artwork. A lot of children draw pictures about their grieving and their thoughts rather than they can't express it verbally like you and I can. And so we're going to have experts come in on a voluntary basis. We're going to put the head office, too, of the Homicide Victim Support Group there. And so we'll have, as I mentioned, education and training facilities as well.
That's wonderful. I've been talking today to retired Chief Inspector of Police, Gary Raymond. And thank you very much for sharing with us today, Gary. And I look forward to our next podcast.
Thanks, Vince, and thanks, everyone.